I'm Shepard Smith. It's now official. The Biden transition to the presidency begin. The announcement, what it means for Team Biden, and reaction from President Trump. The news starts now.
First picks. The Biden administration takes shape. National intelligence, homeland security, what these historic appointments say about the direction of the new White House.
This week is really just the start of the holiday season.
Travel is exploding as the holidays approach, and so is the virus. More people heading to the airport, despite the CDC's plea to stay home.
People in low-income countries can benefit.
AstraZeneca, now the third vaccine proving highly effective. Tonight, how this one's different. The challenges, the timeline, and when Americans can expect a shot in the arm.
Large crowds and gatherings of people is just not something that we can do this year.
Plus, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, COVID style. A sneak peek at what it takes to keep the holiday tradition alive.
Live from CNBC Global Headquarters, the facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith.
And good evening. After weeks of blocking the Biden transition, the Trump administration backed down late this afternoon and is now allowing it to begin. Emily Murphy, the administrator of the General Services Administration, officially signed off on releasing federal funds and other federal resources to the now President-elect Biden's transition team. Murphy says she strongly believes that the law requires her to do so. And she says her decision is not based on fear or favoritism. As for the timing, it happened after Michigan state elections officials certified President-elect Biden's victory in that state today. CNBC's Kayla Tausche on our top story tonight. Kayla, what are we hearing from Biden's team on this?
Well, Shep, tonight Biden's transition says it will immediately set up meetings with federal counterparts, start taking stock of national security issues. The team leading the latter announced today. The GSA ascertainment frees up $6 billion in federal funds, access to classified briefings, and a green light to submit for security clearances. Earlier today, President Trump, after a rare quiet day on Twitter, issued this missive saying he'll keep up his legal fight, but that he made the decision in the best interest of the country to recommend to Murphy and his team to do what needs to be done with initial protocols for the transition. But in her letter, GSA Administrator Emily Murphy, who said she received death threats for the delay, could not have been clearer. She said, "Please know that I came to my decision independently, based on the law and available facts. I was never directly or indirectly pressured by any executive branch official, including those who work at the White House or GSA, with regard to the substance or timing of my decision. To be clear, I did not receive any direction to delay my determination." The move comes after a turning of the tide among Republican lawmakers who have been urging the transition to begin, and after hordes of industry leaders, including many who have supported Trump administration policies, have recently urged the White House and the GSA to make this ascertainment clear. And one notable person who has been echoing those calls, Shep, one of President Trump's closest confidants, private equity magnate Steve Schwarzman. Shep.
Kayla Tausche, thank you. In just a moment, we'll be having much more on the president-elect's transition team and specifically new members of his cabinet. Again, that's coming up in just a moment. 3 days out from Thanksgiving, public health officials have the next 3 days to try to convince Americans to stay home. 3 days to slow what could be a dramatic acceleration of already rapid spread of infections. The United States has now recorded more than 3 million new COVID cases this month alone. That's a quarter of all of our cases to date. And what you're seeing right now, we've been averaging 1,500 deaths a day over the past week, the highest since May. For context, that's an average of more than one death every minute for the past week. And while the CDC has urged people not to travel for the holiday, long, crowded lines have been reported at major airports. More on that from Chicago's O'Hare in a moment. But first, another breakthrough on the vaccine front. AstraZeneca announcing late-stage data shows its vaccine was, on average, 70% effective at preventing the virus. But that's not the whole story. Researchers say the trial looked at two different dosing regimens. Hear this. One was 90% effective when patients received a half dose, followed by a full dose at least a month later. The other was 62% effective when people got two full doses a month apart. Combined, the results showed an average efficacy rate of 70%. But think of it. If a half, then a whole works, that's what they'll do. One footnote, the half dose was never supposed to happen in the first place. It was actually an error, one that turned out to be a very fortunate one. Meantime, a CDC committee met today to discuss vaccines. The conversation included side effects and how those should be communicated to the public. CNBC's Meg Terrell covers science and medicine for us. Meg, this new vaccine could be cheaper and easier to distribute. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Jeff. It really could be. You know, Oxford and AstraZeneca, which are working on this vaccine together, they've established a price of less than $4 a dose compared to closer to $15 or $20 for Pfizer and Moderna. And this vaccine doesn't have to be kept super cold, so it'll be simpler to distribute, particularly to rural areas. But it's not clear the vaccine will have an easy time getting through the FDA, at least with these results. They're from studies run in the UK and Brazil, and the FDA may want to see more data, especially from the U.S. trial. But the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines could be just a few weeks from the FDA's green light. Operation Warp Speed Chief Advisor Moncef Slaoui notes vaccines will start to be shipped within 24 hours of authorization, saying that under the most aggressive timeline, the first shots could be going in people's arms by December 12th. So then the question is, who gets those first doses? A CDC advisory group today outlined a proposal that puts healthcare workers, essential workers, adults with high-risk medical conditions, and the elderly first. Now, the government estimates there will be enough doses for 20 million people in December and then 25 to 30 million each month after that. Now, how soon people not in the priority groups can get vaccinated depends on more vaccines working and adding to supply. But of course, Dr. Anthony Fauci has said by spring or early summer, most Americans should have access, Shep.
Now, Meg, separately, the FDA granted emergency authorization for Regeneron, an antibody drug that was given to President Trump. So this to help you once you have it and not get so sick. How significant is this?
Yeah, it could be an important advance. You know, it's an antibody drug, as you said, made by Regeneron, and it was the first medicine the president was said to have received after he was diagnosed with COVID-19. So the drug here was cleared for people in that same situation for use as soon as possible after diagnosis, and it's specifically for people at high risk for severe disease, so those with obesity, chronic kidney disease, diabetes or immunosuppressive disorders, those older than 65 and others in high-risk groups. And, Shep, that's because supply is constrained here, too. HHS Secretary Alex Azar said the government will have 30,000 doses to ship tomorrow. That's enough for 30,000 people. And Regeneron says it'll have enough for 80,000 people this month, 300,000 by the end of January. But given the numbers of people being diagnosed with COVID every day, that's not going to be enough.
No, Shep. Certainly not. Meg, thank you. America's healthcare workers need all the help they can get right now. Hospitalizations are up for 29 days in a row. Over that time, the number of people hospitalized for the virus has doubled, according to the COVID Tracking Project. The top health official in Pennsylvania says that state could run out of ICU beds within weeks. The state's positivity rate has now spiked to over 10%. And take a look at the front pages from the weekend. The El Paso Times reporting on the deadly truth about COVID. The National Guard deploying troops there to help move bodies of COVID victims into freezer trucks. The situation so bad that El Paso County is hiring inmates at $2 an hour to cart away the dead. And the Minneapolis Star Tribune reports there are no beds anywhere in the state. The crisis also taking a toll on ambulance workers overwhelmed by the surge in patients. NBC News' Ellison Barber live in St. Paul tonight. Ellison, what are EMS workers there facing these days?
Well, Shepard, they say the calls just keep coming. They have not really had a moment to even breathe. And as we see the numbers rise, the hospitalizations go up. Paramedics tell us they are getting more and more calls every day from people having COVID-like symptoms. The state of Minnesota actually asked the federal government to send them staffed ambulances from out of state. And they got 25 of them on Friday. The state says that they will use those ambulances to transfer patients from one hospital to another in an effort to ease hospital bed capacity concerns and free up local EMS to respond to other emergencies. So we spent the day talking to paramedics and doctors at hospitals in the area, trying to get a better sense, a better understanding of what they're dealing with and what they're seeing. Here's a little bit of what we heard.
really, our hospitals have turned into airports that need to take care of a certain amount of people. But they're a little bit, we need to treat them like travelers, that we need to get them from where they're starting, which is maybe not healthy, to a destination of health and safety. But to do that, we're having to move patients a lot more, and our ambulances have really turned into the airplanes to make sure that when there is a bed available, it might not be at the hospital that you want, it might not be in the city that you want, but you need that bed to get better, and our ambulances need to be there to make sure we can get you to where you need to be.
The fire chief with St. Paul's Fire Department told me that they are currently going out on about 15 to 20 calls for COVID-like symptoms every single day. One paramedic I spoke to, he said he has been out on at least 100 calls since the pandemic started for people exhibiting COVID-like symptoms. And those are not people that are asymptomatic and later test positive for COVID-19. They say they are under a lot of stress here. And every day, Shepard, it seems to get worse.
Ellison Barber in St. Paul. Now, the virus gripping those working inside one of America's hospitals is just it's just crazy now. New today, the Cleveland Clinic reports 970 caregivers are out due to COVID. Think of that. Triple the number from just 2 weeks ago. The hospital, of course, in a region where cases are on the rise. On the left, you see the daily cases have jumped since September. On the right, same for hospitalizations, adding about 35 patients every day. Kelly Hancock is with us now. She's the Cleveland Clinic's chief caregiver officer. Thank you so much for being here. Thinking through this, I'm like, if the Cleveland Clinic, I mean, it's the Cleveland Clinic, and they've got 960 people they can't keep safe to treat patients. I don't know what's coming for the rest of us.
Well, you're absolutely right. Good evening. Thanks for having us. So as we've seen the increased number of cases rise in the state of Ohio, we had a record today. We saw nearly 12,000 new cases in the state of Ohio of COVID-positive patients. And so when you think about the increase in the hospitalizations that results in, it's incredible. And as you mentioned, we're experiencing close to 1,000 of our caregivers who've been affected by COVID-19 and unable to come in and care for those patients. Luckily for us, in Northeast Ohio, we have a large health system here, and we have adequate bed capacity. But we really need to ensure that our caregivers, are able to come into work so we can care for those patients who do have COVID-19, as well as our other patients who have other clinical conditions.
Sure. Are you reaching a point where doctors and nurses are sick at such numbers that it's going to be difficult to give the care that people at Cleveland Clinic are used to getting?
Right now, we have adequate staffing. We're able to really mobilize our caregivers to the areas where they're needed most. But we continue to meet frequently throughout the day to continue to assess the situation for both of our caregivers as well as the bed capacity.
Yeah, I see your numbers, and we remind ourselves every day, these aren't numbers. These are human beings who are
Absolutely.
Suffering mightily. And there are more than 1,000 human beings in intensive care in your state alone for the first time for this pandemic. It's one thing if we're able to get it under control and bring the numbers down. Kelly, that's not happening. The numbers
that's
are the numbers are going up. And in a position like yours, I just wonder how concerned you are, not about tomorrow, but, a couple of weeks after Thanksgiving, where in the world we're going to be.
Well, we're deeply concerned about the rising cases, and particularly for our caregivers. The power is really with all of us right now. As members of our community, we could really take this into control. We ensure we have to listen to our public health officials. We have to ensure that we adhere to the safety measures, wearing our mask. We know that wearing a mask helps slow the spread of the disease, and wearing it appropriately over your nose and over your mouth. The social distancing is important. Making sure that we don't, particularly with the holidays coming up, go to large gatherings. And of course, frequent hand washing. All of this is really concerning for all of us, and we need to do all of this to ensure that we can keep our caregivers at work.
Kelly Hancock from Cleveland Clinic, all the best to you and all of our heroes there and in hospitals across the country. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
President-elect Biden, as we mentioned earlier, is now announcing his first cabinet picks, a whole list of them, to lead his national security and foreign policy teams. Some of the nominees are making history, many of the faces familiar from the Obama administration. Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken was President Obama's Deputy Secretary of State. Biden's pick for National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan helped broker the Iran nuclear deal. Alejandro Mayorkas is the first Latino and immigrant nominated to lead the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees ICE and Border Patrol. He was born in Cuba, served as President Obama's deputy DHS secretary. If confirmed, Avril Haines will be the first woman to serve as Director of National Intelligence, America's top spy chief. The president-elect bringing back former Secretary of State John Kerry. This time he'll be the climate change czar under President Biden. Secretary Kerry helped craft the Paris Climate Accord, the landmark deal from which President Trump pulled the United States. And President-elect Biden has chosen Janet Yellen to be the Treasury Secretary. The former Federal Reserve Chair would be the first woman to fill that cabinet seat. NBC News' Ali Vitale now. Ali, what do these picks say about the Biden administration's direction here?
That a premium is being put on expertise and having been in these spaces before. Everyone who was announced today has some prior government or diplomatic experience to speak of. So when they come into these roles, this is certainly not the first time that they are getting into the space of being in government. Janet Yellen, for example, former Fed chair, now being placed in a potentially historic position as head of the Treasury. She is going to be someone who placates a few different parts of the Democratic Party, both progressive and moderates. And she has a tall order in front of her as she tries both to get the country's economy back on track amidst a recession that's happening during an ongoing pandemic, but also as she tries to tackle some larger agenda items for Democrats, such as closing the wealth gap that has been so persistent in this country. So Joe Biden today making those picks public, but also acknowledging, as he appeared here today in Wilmington, that just because the picks are out does not mean the process is anywhere close to over, because these people still have to be Senate confirmed. Listen.
So do you expect Republicans to put up any significant roadblocks to your nominations?
Are you kidding me?
why'd you go with national security first?
Because it's national security.
So this road is a little bit easier now, though, Shep, because, as you mentioned, that letter of ascertainment, that long-awaited letter that will allow them to officially begin the transition, has finally been transmitted to the Biden team. That means, yes, they can officially begin talking with people in the agencies, but also that the all-important process of background checks can begin, because a lot of these people, although they've been in government before and have seen high security clearances already, that is a process that needs to take place before they can get into office in January and really hit the ground running.
Ali, thanks so much. You know, despite the pleas, the numbers, the stories, many people are still not following the Fauci. Airports packed with Thanksgiving travelers. But there is something people are doing a lot of from home.
People will spend, but much of it will be done online.
The nightmare before Christmas. Just how delayed will your Christmas gifts be this year? How a new COVID experiment in the hometown of the Beatles could hold the secret to reopening cities in America.
Just put it up your nose so you feel a little bit of resistance.
Plus, the story behind this unbelievable car crash.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 60 seconds.
Well, the pandemic's not getting in the way of holiday shopping. The National Retail Federation is now forecasting people will spend more money this season than last. Somewhere between 3% and 5% more. That's a lot. And that means a strong end to the 2020 year for retailers. Economists say people spent less time on travel and entertainment, so why not blow it on holiday gifts? But that also creates a logistical nightmare for shippers. How to deliver all those toys and televisions and furniture on time? Here's CNBC's Frank Holland.
This is what Black Friday used to be about. Shoppers rushing big box stores for deals.
There's no way this year I would go near the stores.
Instead of waiting online for doorbusters this holiday season, Gabby Vittoria is shopping online for her two kids.
Social distancing, I cannot imagine, is going to happen on Black Friday. And I just need to be safe for myself, for my family.
Online shopping from Black Friday to Small Business Saturday to Cyber Monday is forecast to surge more than 35% over last year. The avalanche of online buying is expected to create major delays for shippers like FedEx, UPS, Amazon, and the Post Office. 7 million packages a day will have delayed delivery, according to one estimate. As many as 700 million all around the world won't make it by Christmas, according to another. With supply chains so overwhelmed, you should pick your presents as soon as possible, according to the chief marketing officer of FedEx.
We've also seen coming in from overseas that there is some inventory constraints. So if you see that special gift you know you need under that tree, I would definitely purchase it now.
And the pandemic's weighing on the minds of many shoppers out there. According to a new poll released by Deloitte today, 3/4 of shoppers say they're going to skip shopping in the stores altogether and do all of their shopping online. Just last year, that number was much lower, 62%. Shep?
Frank, a safety group warning about dangerous toys ahead of Christmas. Here's the 10 worst toys from World Against Toys Causing Harm, or Watch. Very clever. The group says they contain hidden hazards. Take these Coleco critters, for example. Watch warns children can choke on them because of some very small parts. Marvel Avengers Vibranium Power FX Claw is also on the list, the toy based on the blockbuster movie. Watch says there's a potential for injuries to little eyes and little faces. Finally, these WWE Jumbo Superstar Fists made the list. Of course they did. They allow kids to be their favorite pro wrestlers. Watch points out no warnings and no cautions provided regarding the potential for blunt force or impact injuries. The Toy Association represents toy manufacturers. A spokesperson told us in part that the watch list is, quoting now, needlessly frightening parents and caregivers with misinformation. Before we can get to Christmas, we have to get past Thanksgiving, right? Millions are already traveling for the holiday, even as the CDC says do not travel for the holiday. The TSA screened more than 1 million people in airports yesterday in the U.S. That's more than on any day since the pandemic began, but half of what they screened the same time last year. People are hoping to test negative before heading home, and they're keeping testing sites full. Long lines in Tampa, Denver, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and really cities and towns all across the nation. Some sites forced to close early because of high demand and lack of tests. Jay Gray's live at Chicago's O'Hare. What have the crowds been like there today, Jay?
Hey, Shep, travelers have been coming through in waves. Very busy this morning. Then we had a bit of a lull. This evening we had a rush. Had it not been for the mask people were wearing, you might have thought it was so crowded it was pre-COVID here. Look, we are seeing a lot of families traveling right now. That despite a plea from nurses, doctors, health officials, elected officials from the local level through the federal government for people to stay at home this holiday. When you talk to those who are traveling, many will tell you for them right now, months of restrictions and lockdowns are just not as scary to them as the need to be with family and friends for the holiday. That's just a much stronger draw than any fear of infection.
We just felt like, okay, well, it doesn't seem like it's getting any better. So, I mean, we might as well just try to just have a little bit of fun without getting sick.
Yeah, and I think an important point in all of this, Shep, is the fact that this is just the first week of what traditionally is a very heavy volume holiday travel season. We should begin to find out what it's meant as far as Thanksgiving travel in a couple of weeks as people are gearing up to travel again for Christmas.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jay Gray. Remember the ice bucket challenge? People pouring icy water over their heads to spread awareness and get donations for ALS? Well, one of the men who helped launch the trend died over the weekend. Patrick Quinn was just 37 years old. Doctors diagnosed him with ALS back in 2013. The disease destroys the nerve cells that control the way you move and speak, even breathe. The ice bucket challenge took social media by storm, you'll remember. Videos of celebrities, including Justin Timberlake, Bill Gates, even President Trump helped register millions of views around the world. The challenge went on to raise, look at that, $220 million, according to the ALS Association. The organization says that challenge dramatically accelerated the fight against ALS and led to brand new research. 2020, the year that brought us a lot of firsts, including language. So much of that, Oxford couldn't narrow down to just one word of the year. The phrase is changing our life next. And fancy a swab? A British city's experiment with mass rapid testing, with results being called remarkable. Plus, months after a fast-moving windstorm uprooted part of our nation, homes are still in ruins. the slow-moving road to recovery in the Midwest. A TikTok copycat that's paying users. That's what's topping CNBC's On the Money. Snapchat making a big bet on viral videos. The social media company launching Spotlight, a service to allow users to share short clips. But get this, Snap is paying more than $1 million a day to users who post what they deem to be the best content. Snap wants you to spend more time on the app, which it hopes will result in more ad dollars. Guitar Center playing a sad song. The biggest musical instrument retailer in all the country filing for bankruptcy. The company is now forced to close many of its stores with the pandemic struck. The CEO says he expects to emerge from Chapter 11 by sometime around the end of the year. And The Queen's Gambit, Netflix's most popular limited scripted series ever. 62 million households watched the program in its first 28 days. The story of a chess prodigy has people everywhere buying chess boards. eBay seeing a 215% spike in sales. Goliath Games a 1,000% increase, according to NPR. On Wall Street, the Dow up 327. Positive news on COVID vaccines and treatments put investors in a buying mood. The S&P gained 20, the NASDAQ up 25. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news. Pennsylvania's health secretary banning alcohol sales at bars and restaurants for just one night, Wednesday night, starting at 5. You can't buy booze in that state on the big night before Thanksgiving until 8 o'clock Thanksgiving morning. In D.C., the mayor limiting indoor gatherings to 10 people starting on Wednesday. The order caps outdoor groups at 25. And Los Angeles County, they're shutting down all dining at restaurants and bars as cases skyrocket. They're allowed to stay open for takeout, drive-through, and delivery, but that's it. The new measure starts on Wednesday, and they are set to last at least 3 weeks. New restrictions in New York, too. CNBC's Contessa Brewer in Lower Manhattan. Contessa?
Hi there, Shep. Yeah, here's what we're looking at. The governor in New York has said that indoor dining can remain open. However, he's announced more restriction to parts of New York City and Long Island today. But let me show you this. All over the city, you've got these plywood sheds just being erected, replacing those outdoor tents as the colder weather moves in. Now, businesses around the nation are trying to adapt to these tougher restrictions amid record-breaking new coronavirus cases.
My first reaction was, oh my God, what do I tell my team?
Los Angeles County forbidding even outdoor dining for 3 weeks. Madeline Alfano, owner of Maria's Italian Kitchen and chair of the California Restaurant Association, worries about these businesses surviving.
This challenge of after investing hundreds and thousands of dollars to create an outdoor dining space. It's devastating, and it's heartbreaking for so many small businesses. 60% who are of color.
In Nevada, the governor has ordered casinos to reduce capacity from 50% to 25% as new cases top 2,000 per day. And in New York,
I feel safe in this new reality of eating outdoors.
Outdoor dining is beginning to resemble indoor dining. Nervous restaurateurs are trying to keep their options open, even as they enclose their tables for winter. James Hamblin tweeted about it, a writer for The Atlantic and an MD certified in preventive medicine. He worries how safe it is.
If you find yourself in essentially a new building with four walls and a roof, and you're really enclosed with people, you have to realize that if they are infected, you will be infected, and vice versa.
The city tells me that these enclosed structures are permitted, but if they don't keep the side walls open, closed in like this one is, they're going to be subject to the same 25% capacity as indoor dining shop.
Okay, Contessa Brewer, thanks. Have you had that visit to your favorite spot where you hear they're about to close down because of the rising cases? A guy in Cleveland did, so he paid it forward, left a hefty tip to help the workers out. The place is called Nighttown. The workers posted this receipt online. They say a man walked in, ordered a beer, left a $3,000 tip on his $7 charge, then told the four employees on duty at the time to split up the money. They thanked him, and he said he's looking forward to when they return. The United Kingdom is ending its month-long lockdown next week, returning to a strict tier system. The Prime Minister there, Boris Johnson, also says that in certain hot spots, he plans to increase mass testing, like the kind they're using in Liverpool. That city is part of an experiment. All residents given free rapid tests. Hundreds of thousands took them, and the positivity rate in Liverpool dropped nearly 90% in 1 month. Mass testing is really important, and we cannot get it right in the United States, not yet. It's important because it identifies not just the sick, but the asymptomatic, people who feel fine and would walk around spreading the virus and wouldn't otherwise get tested. NBC's Willem Marks on the bold new strategy.
Last month, Liverpool was the UK's top COVID hotspot. A strict second lockdown's largely emptied the streets of the Beatles' birthplace and most stores are closed, but customers are now lining up at dozens of new testing centres. Like this storied soccer stadium filled not with fans, but swab stations where residents like Emily Wang can get tested for free.
Just put it up your nose till you feel a little bit of resistance.
Once this lateral flow test develops, she's alerted by text, receiving result in just 20 minutes.
So my test result was negative, so that's good news.
The pilot programme of Rapid City testing will radically reduce the infection rate if enough citizens turn up for frequent testing.
We need it to work so that we can protect people's lives, but also protect the livelihoods of people as well.
The British government's committed tens of billions of dollars to what it calls a moonshot testing strategy. The Liverpool experiment is part of that effort, and though the costs associated with the new citywide campaign have not yet been calculated, some scientists question whether voluntary mass testing programs can provide value for money, or even prove effective.
Benefit of a test is only in what then comes after that test. And if you're still not able to contact trace effectively, then why are we testing at a mass level?
But if well targeted, this kind of wide-scale cross-government approach could be replicated in US communities, according to Dr. Kitao Demisi, dean of the SUNY Downstate School of Public Health.
It is a very effective way of identifying people who are infected and also cutting the transmission chain of the disease.
This city's certainly seen successful exports before, and this aggressive testing approach might help shorten America's long and winding road to recovery. For the news, I'm Willem Marks.
An unprecedented year leading to an unprecedented decision by Oxford English Dictionary. Instead of one word of the year, it names several. The dictionary's president, Casper Grothwall, told us why.
We chose words of the year as opposed to picking a singular word of the year this year, because when we looked at the evidence, we realized that there was linguistic change and upheaval that was going on that was parallel to what was happening in the rest of our lives. We have hundreds of editors and lexicographers who are looking at any given moment at how English is evolving in various parts of the world. What we found so interesting this year is that spikes in usage that might point to a good candidate for the word of the year were happening constantly.
Well, the list includes coronavirus. It dates to the 1960s, but really not many of us had used it before, right? And COVID-19, of course, a completely new term, first recorded on February the 11th. Then the words lockdown, social distancing, and reopening all spiked, as did COVIDiot. As in COVID idiot or someone who disobeys the guidelines. Then over the summer, Black Lives Matter and BLM exploded, those becoming a rallying cry. Two more to add to the lexicon, doom scrolling, defined as the action of compulsively scrolling through bad news on social media. And finally, Blur's Day, as in, what the hell day is it? I don't even know anymore. Call it Blur's Day. Last year, Oxford did pick just one word, or really one phrase, climate emergency. No less serious now than it was then. We just don't talk about it as much. The U.S. this year slammed by a record-tying 16 climate disaster, described as those costing more than $1 billion each. In August, A derecho ripped through the Corn Belt. High winds and tornadoes caused $7.5 billion in damage. One of the hardest hit areas was in Iowa. More than 1,000 homes destroyed in the town of Cedar Rapids alone. That's 1,000 families. We met one of them on the road to recovery. A powerful windstorm ripping through the Midwest. 140-mile-an-hour gusts tearing through neighborhoods, destroying homes. Meteorologists call it a derecho. And as one wreaked havoc back in August, families from Iowa to Indiana braced for the worst.
I'm just thinking that, pray to God that the house doesn't cave in.
Thankfully, the roof stayed sturdy on the Miles family home in Cedar Rapids. But when the couple and their three daughters emerged from the basement after the storm had passed, disbelief.
We went out the back door and it literally was like we were walking into a whole different world.
While family and friends came together to help, nothing could be done to salvage their 2,000-square-foot, 100-year-old house.
The insurance adjuster immediately told us, just start packing everything up. You can't stay here.
And that was pretty much the end of any quick answers. More than 3 months later, virtually zero progress has been made on what's left of their home.
It's hard to even find people in the area who will do the demo job.
The derecho's massive path of destruction, leaving 1,000 homes in desperate need of repair, creating more work than contractors in the area can handle. Another hurdle, the skyrocketing cost of building materials. The insurance company offered $200 a square foot to rebuild. The couple says contractors tell them it's not enough. They'll likely have to rebuild a smaller home. And just this month, the family confronted COVID firsthand. Lindsay testing positive. The family hunkering down yet again.
Happy birthday to you.
When you're dealing with the situation of the derecho and you got COVID on top of that, loss of home. With all those scenarios, my kind of mentality is if it's this bad, like, there's better days ahead.
For now, Lindsay and Ed expect to stay in the townhouse they're renting, where life marches on towards those better days. Well, demolition of their home is still months away, but some good news. Lindsay told us just tonight that she's out of quarantine and feeling better from COVID. And luckily, the kids never got it at all. Well, did they or didn't they? Conflicting reports about whether there was a meeting between Israel's prime minister and the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. The historic step this would be. And cars flipping over. Look at that. A man diving out of the way. Not the scene of a Hollywood movie. That is real. And a stop on our trip around the world in 80 seconds.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 90 seconds.
Saudi Arabia is now denying reports that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu flew in for a secret meeting with Saudi Crown Prince MBS. But of course, the Saudis, they'll say, you know, the two countries have a bitter and bloody history. The covert rendezvous, if it happened, actually, would be a historic step toward easing the tensions in the Middle East. Here's NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Richard Engel.
Shep, politics in the Middle East are often personal, often hard to understand, often with a hidden hand. But this is a very strange story. For the last several months, even as the Trump administration is ending up moving into its final days, it has been pushing for the Arab world to recognize Israel. And throughout the editorials in the newspapers in the region, everyone has been asking, will Saudi Arabia be next? And it is something that Israel desperately wants. Israel wants normalization with the Arab world without having to make major concessions on the ground and give up land, give up territory, give up Jerusalem. Did it happen? The Israeli media says it did. Israeli officials say it did, that during this visit on which Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went to an Israeli settlement, a Jewish settlement in the West Bank, which much of the world considers illegal, infuriating the Palestinians, doing something that in the Arab world would have been unthinkable in the past, that he then, according to the Israeli media, left with the Israeli prime minister and went to Saudi Arabia. Now, is that a way to pressure the Saudis into going along? The Saudis then denied it. Did it happen, but the Saudis didn't think the Israelis would publicize it? very hard to know, but it shows how, even in these last final days, this administration is trying to drive one of its clearest foreign policy objectives over the finish line. Shep?
Richard, thanks. A musician plays for a curious crowd, and protesters set fire to a major political site as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Guatemala. Outrage over spending cuts spilling into the streets. Protesters breaking into the Congress building and lighting it on fire. Officers shooting tear gas in response. Local media say the budget slashes education and health care funding, but gives lawmakers more money to pay for their meals. China, a Hollywood-style collision. Look at this. A truck loses control, crashes into a car, sending it rolling onto its side. A man on the shoulder seen running for his life. The car eventually teeters and then falls off the highway. All five people involved somehow survived. Officials say they were all wearing seatbelts. Spain. Police in Madrid using drones to keep crowds in check. They launched the drones after a popular flea market reopened. COVID forced it to close for 8 months. Back in business now with half the crowd and eyes overhead. Thailand. A little Fiora Lisa for some furry friends. A piano player harnessing the power of music to bring attention to hungry monkeys. Visitors typically feed them, but COVID cut into tourism and the monkeys' food supply. The musician's still playing, even as they monkey around him.
Wonderful opportunity to see wild animals just being themselves.
Playing for a cause as we go round the world in 80 seconds. No kids and no crowds. Just two of the changes coming to the Thanksgiving Day parade. How Macy's plans to pull it all off. And welcome to the Thunderdome. Two birds enter, one bird leaves. Who shall prevail and be pardoned? Corn or cob? The presidential turkeys get names each year. Corn and cob are the 2020 offerings. They arrived in D.C. today from Iowa. Here's their red carpet entrance at the Willard Hotel. President Trump is to grant one of them a presidential pardon, but per tradition, both will be spared from the dining table. The White House says Cobb has a type A personality. Hobbies include pickleball and puzzles. That's what it says. Corn, we're told, is chatty. Loves college football and hopes to one day visit the Iowa State Fair. Tough choice. Unless, of course, Corn is like a corn dog and LSU fan, then we're for Cobb. COVID has messed with a lot of things, right? But this is America, and we will not let it mess with our balloons. Hello, boss baby. The little guy is one of the new balloons you'll see during Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade, if you decide to watch. The other one is Red Titan here, some sort of YouTube star, IDK. Usually, the new balloons are among the biggest parade changes, but not this year. Here's CNBC's Andrea Day.
When I found out that we weren't going, it was definitely a hard pill to swallow.
High school junior Gracia Garcia Rodriguez is drum major for the Ohio Centerville Jazz Band, one of several groups no longer performing in this year's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade due to COVID.
I understand the reason for it, and I respect the reason for it, but it's still a bummer.
It's part of five big changes this year. First one, age restrictions. You have to be over 18 to perform, and that means hundreds of kids and chaperones no longer attending. It will dramatically decrease crowds. Parade officials say those students who miss out performing this year are invited back next year. Big change number two.
There is no parade route for people to come and watch live. Definitely safety was our number one priority in this event.
Last year's parade spanned 2.5 miles. This year, it will all go down on one block, right in front of Macy's. Third big change, no crowds. Last year, 3.5 million people turned out to watch the parade. This year, live spectators discouraged.
Large crowds and gatherings of people is just not something that we can do this year.
Fourth change, not as much live coverage. While the balloons rolling to Macy's and Herald Square will be live, many of the performances will not be. The Broadway casts of Jagged Little Pill, Hamilton, and others delivering their musical acts pre-taped ahead of time. Big change number five, no balloon handlers. Usually around 100 people hold the balloons down with their body weight. This year,
so we came up with a plan to replace all of those multitudes of handlers with additional utility vehicles.
Here, they are testing that concept. One thing that won't be changing, the big finale.
The parade ends with the biggest celebrity of them all, and that's Santa Claus. He's been social distancing.
It's kind of like 2020. It is what it is, and you just gotta look forward.
Well said, Gracia. And Shep, parade officials tell us instead of those high school marching bands, they are going to have performances from parades that were canceled this year due to COVID. Now, that's including the St. Patrick's Day Parade, the Puerto Rican Day Parade, and the Pride Parade. And great news tonight for all those high school seniors, the ones who can't march this year, you are invited back next Thanksgiving.
All right, Shep? Andrea, thank you. A symbol of love goes down the drain. And a police officer acts fast when a man gets caught in a fiery crash on this CNBC trip, coast to coast.
New Jersey, a dramatic rescue caught on video. See that burning minivan? There's a man trapped in there. Howell Township Police say one of their officers jumped into action.
Come on, man.
The officer pulled the man through the window and out of harm's way. The driver shaken up, but says he's doing okay. New York, a deer with a paint can stuck on its head. The animal fell into a lake on Long Island. Rescuers pulled the can off.
I got it.
Then guided the deer to shore.
Go ahead.
It ran off and didn't look like it was hurt. California, a woman in the Bay Area says she lost her wedding ring when she accidentally flushed it down the toilet. She says it happened in September.
I figured out that in the sewer pipes, it was long, long gone.
2 months later, a great idea from a friend. Call the local wastewater treatment plant. So she says she did. Turns out a crew had just cleared debris from one of the sewers near her home, we're told. After raking the pile and using a metal detector, they say they found the ring. Washington, D.C. The votes are in, and this little guy's new name is Xiao Qiji. Mandarin for Little Miracle. The giant panda born 3 months ago at the Smithsonian National Zoo. Zookeepers say he'll move to China once he turns 4 years old after a CNBC trip coast to coast.
So how much you love your pet? Enough to wrestle with an alligator? Richard Wilbanks does, and there's video. Florida man wrestling his puppy from the jaws of death. Look here now. He didn't even drop his cigar. Richard Wilbanks enjoying the sun at his Southwest Florida home when he heard his puppy named Gunner crying. As it turned out, Gunner was clamped in the mouth of a gator.
Oh, it was just a shock. It happened so fast that, instinct just took over. Adrenaline kicked in and I just went right in the water after the gator and Gunner.
And got Gunner right out of that gator right quick. All captured on camera by the Florida Wildlife Federation. See, Wilbanks allows that group to put its cameras up and monitor the wild habitat around its property, right? So the footage was actually from back in October, but they found it when they came around to collect the memory cards. Wilbanks says he had only a couple of cuts and that Gunner is doing just fine. 60 seconds left on a race to the finish. The Trump administration allowing the Biden transition to begin at last after blocking it for weeks. The GSA's Emily Murphy says it was her own decision and not that of the White House. President-elect Biden announcing his first cabinet picks. Some of the nominees making history. If confirmed, that cabinet will include the first Latino Homeland Security Secretary, the first woman serving as Director of National Intelligence. And another breakthrough in the race for a COVID vaccine. AstraZeneca announcing its candidate is highly effective and cheaper than that of the Pfizer or Moderna companies. And now, you know the news. For this Monday, November the 23rd, 2020, I'm Shepard Smith. Follow us on Twitter at The News on CNBC. And with Thanksgiving coming, by all means, if you can, follow the Fauci so we're not all sick. Okay? guess what's next? Shark Tank! You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.